too happy there.
I'm happy that my working out gives me dopamine on its own, so I don't have to trick myself into thinking about, oh, if you work out, then I'll reward you. Working out is its own reward for me.
So what's interesting about that is that I think there's going to be a very good space in the discussion we're going to have tomorrow with the Full Book Club about that. When I was writing up the discussion prompts for this week, that thought occurred to me. But I would agree with you. For me, working out itself is very energizing, and I look forward to the workout itself. Of course, the results and outcomes that I hope to achieve through my working out, you know, I want them, that I like working towards them, and I like achieving the goals I set. And I guess I shouldn't call it working out. I should call it training, because I do, like, what I do is only done with certain goals and achievements in mind.
I wonder if that goal-oriented idea, when you think about training, is part of what gives you your dopamine, because you're heading towards an achievement. Similar to what we were talking about in the book Atomic Habits right now, he has that nice diagram of cue, craving, response, reward. So if that reward of achieving a goal, which floods your brain with dopamine, say like finishing a Tough Mudder or finishing a marathon or pulling a brand new personal record, you get flooded with that dopamine. So I wonder if you having that goal-oriented mentality of training adds to that dopamine flooding.
Well, I use the word training specifically just because I'm very versed in Mark Ripito's starting strength methodology, and I've read his books, and he makes a very good case for there's a clear difference between training and exercise, which we can talk about if you'd like. But specifically for me, when it comes to getting into the gym and doing whatever I'm doing in the gym, which for me, I call that training for specific reasons, that process itself is a lot of fun and very intrinsically rewarding, just doing that. However, in terms of what we're reading right now for Book Club Atomic Habits, originally when I first really got into exercise and working out, it was much more focused on the desired outcome rather than the process itself. I was not very fit and I wanted to get more fit. I was young and awkward and overweight and wanted to fix those aspects about myself. And so I chose dieting and working out. And over the process of several years, I did achieve the outcomes I wanted to achieve. Along the way, it became part of my identity. Nowadays, I don't feel right if I don't get to get in the gym and do the stuff I want to do as frequently as I want to do it. Start getting itchy.
Well, it almost sounds like you've already pre-programmed your brain after doing it for so long that those habits have become systems set in place, and now those systems have now created that identity, right? You're not, oh, my habit is working out. Part of your identity is being healthy. You don't think of yourself like, oh, I have to be healthy. You just automatically, I am healthy, therefore I do these things.
Well, I do consider the two things hand in hand, healthy and working out. But if I were to think about my sense of identity, it's not that I am healthy and a healthy person works out, to kind of use the language that James Clear has in the Atomic Habits book. For me, it's more so that, like, part of my identity is working out. And yes, that is related to being healthy, and part of my identity is health oriented and being healthy and wanting to be healthy. But really, just training to train is part of the identity, which makes, you know, getting particular results in the gym much more easy for me than someone who is not used to having that.
I feel like when I see successful people and people that I admire for what they do, they typically have an enjoyment of the process. If you only enjoy the product, I don't often see long-term success in those people. When I've seen people play music or study a degree to get a doctorate or anything else, if all you want is that end result, you can usually push yourself for a little bit, but it's hard to push yourself long enough to achieve long-term lasting goals. So there has to be some enjoyment of the process. You can't say, I only enjoy playing on concert. You have to enjoy practicing the music for the concert.
I think there's an argument for both sides, right? So, and this is something that, we're going to talk about tomorrow with the main group. But early on in the book, Atomic Habits, James Clear talks about shifting from working at the process level to a deeper, more identity-based level. Instead of focusing on the outcome you want, which is to read more, focus on the actual systems process of what it would be like to read more, and then go a step further and work on the identity level. Rather than read a book, change it to, I'm a reader. Like, make that part of your identity. What would someone who's a reader do right now? Would they turn on the Netflix, or would they grab the book that's sitting on the nightstand? So working at the identity level, there's an argument. There's an argument both ways. So he says that at the beginning of the book, and then later on in the book, in the part we just read this week for book club, was that habits, in a sense, are an obstacle in and of themselves, and what you really want is the outcome. So he's almost arguing the opposite here. To me, at the surface level, it seems kind of at odds with the identity and process-based thinking. So one of the examples he gives is that, you know, you don't want the meditation habit itself, you want the outcome it grants, which is clearer thinking or to be calmer. To your point, if you enjoy the process, that makes it much more likely that you're successful. The opposite argument is that if you want to be really good at something or really accomplish something or just accomplish a lot of things, you want to be a little bit more outcome focused, a little bit more goal oriented. So there's a tension there, I think, that I'm eager to discuss with the main book club group of, you know, that tension between focusing on a goal, getting to it, and, you know, by any means necessary, and making it as easy as possible, versus enjoying the process itself. So going back to working out, I really enjoy both, and I get pleasure out of both. You know, achieving specific goals. Like back in the day, I had never done a handstand push-up before. I felt really good after the handful of months that I really focused on getting that goal and building up to it and doing a full handstand push-up. That was great. That felt great. But at the same time, I really enjoy just being in the gym itself. So now goals are kind of secondary to that for me. Does that make sense, that tension between the two?
Sure. It makes sense, the tension between the two. And there's plenty of times you, I, and most people can think of a period in their life where they didn't enjoy the process, but they wanted or needed the outcome and were able to achieve that. And that is a perfectly valid thing. Like doing the dishes. It needs to be done. You don't have to enjoy the process of washing dishes to do it every day, because it's a thing that needs to be done and your goal is to have a clean kitchen. But I'm saying for lifelong achievements, like that of a professional degree or martial arts or becoming a musician, those things for year after year after year, at some point, you're going to have to enjoy the process. Not the whole process, but you got to enjoy some part of the process. Otherwise, you won't keep coming back to it.
Do you think there's good examples of both? You know, I'm thinking of like professional musicians, particularly, especially classical-oriented musicians who are just from childhood, like grinding away hours a day, focused on becoming a great musician. You know, that doesn't seem very enjoyable. And a lot of them, you know, talk about how difficult that is and the difficulty of doing that. How much intrinsic enjoyment do you think there is for people like that? Same thing with martial arts or fighters. You know, they spend so much effort and so much discipline on the grind itself and are very goal oriented. You know, they want to be a great fighter for the prestige and the status, or they want to be a great musician for the same reason, or to make a name for themselves. And I've seen examples of both. You and me know a certain very quirky Italian martial artist who very much enjoys the process, you know, and therefore it's part of his lifelong habits. And we've also met people who are super goal-oriented, very accomplished, and they are more kind of beholden to the goal and a little bit more blind to the journey itself. So are these two different ways of getting to the same thing? Does one side work better for certain personality types than the other? What do you think?
Sure. I think both are a perfectly valid way to approach achieving things in life. Ultimately, with our dopamine and the pursuit of dopamine and having our motivation, right? There, whatever that motivation is, there's still a dopamine response in our brain to it. Remove the dopamine response and we won't have the motivation to even stay alive. So I think you can have both directions to accomplish that goal. And sure, I think Beethoven was one of the classical musicians that he was forced to play instruments when he was a child, and he ultimately ended up hating it, but that was his whole life, if I'm thinking of the correct thing. Tiger Woods is another one where he talks about when he was a small kid, he had to golf no matter what. His parents forced him. And there's plenty of other, what we would say is accomplished or successful people that we know about, that they talk about the very negative aspect of being forced to pursue a goal even as a young child, no matter what. And perhaps they don't enjoy the process, but that's just part of their livelihood now. I think in general, short-term goals are much easier to achieve if you are goal-oriented or outcome-oriented. And I do think we have plenty of examples of people that enjoy the journey but don't enjoy the destination at all. And so sometimes they just enjoy the process but then never accomplish anything that we would say, such as like a bow tie on a book.
What do you mean by bow tie on a book?
As in completing the book. So there's plenty of people that work on projects.
Finish it, put a bow on it.
Yeah, and okay. They never finish it to say, here is this finished product or this finished result. They just enjoyed the journey of learning about whatever task.
So like the best example or a good example of what you're talking about would be like a musician who's talented and skilled and enjoys what they're doing, but doesn't necessarily have any particular outcomes they want out of that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So they are like, well, I want to learn jazz now. So then they study jazz, learn jazz, do all that, but they never perform a concert. They never record a song. They never do anything. They just enjoyed the journey of learning.
And then you also said short-term outcomes are better served by being much more goal-oriented and not focusing on the journey so much.
That would be my initial hypothesis.
I mean, that's been my lived experience, to go back to the exercise and training example, is in the beginning, I was very focused on losing weight, getting fit, and being more confident. Now, it's just kind of who I am. Part of that is that I'm just 10, 15 years older now, so I'm a lot more comfortable with where I'm at my life stage. I'm not so concerned about certain aspects. And part of it is that I've got a lot of reps under my belt of proving to myself that I am accomplished in physical aspects and exercise and training. And I think maybe for some people in certain situations, you need to start in one to transition into the other. You know, so you can, and we could probably make the argument both ways, where for me, in that particular example, it was, you know, very short-term focused, very goal-focused, that eventually, over the years, changed into the other version, enjoying the process, enjoying the journey, and focusing on the journey aspect of it much more than the goal aspect. Now, the goals are kind of in the background. I'm still making great progress. I'm not wasting my time in the gym, at least from my perspective. But now it's much more journey focused. And then the other way around, let's see if we can think of an example of going the opposite direction. Starting off, just kind of enjoying the activity or process, or in the language of habits, enjoying, you know, the behavior, the habit itself. Reading would be a good example for me. I've enjoyed reading my entire life since I could read, since before I can read. I enjoyed some of my favorite memories as a young kid was Dad reading to me, you know, reading stories to me, that whole nighttime or bedtime ritual of talking about stories. He would make up stories sometimes, and we'd also read books together. And, you know, I naturally kind of morphed into that. My personality is very much in the direction of curiosity and learning, and I can very happily spend a lot of my time studying or learning just on my own. So for many years, that was just part of, I just enjoyed that process. Now with, you know, being in book club and having this great group of people that we discuss stuff with, it's a little bit more goal focused and outcome focused, because now I'm looking for books and reading books specifically with the goal in mind of having a good discussion at book club. And I write up the prompts each week for us to have a good discussion. I really enjoy that activity, and it's much more goal-focused. So that would be an example that I can think of going from just enjoying the process to shifting powerfully into being short-term and goal-focused. Yeah, do you think of some examples of going from one to the other and vice versa?
I think there's plenty of examples of going from the short-term outcome focused or goal focused to enjoying that journey or process. Working out, I think, is an easy one for a lot of people that become lifelong exercise, you know, oriented people. The other way, one thing that comes to mind for me is languages. I've always enjoyed the journey of studying languages. Every time I had the ability to be around other people speaking different languages, I would ask them how to learn certain things, and I would learn different linguistical components to then be able to communicate in those languages, mostly because I love being extroverted and interacting with people and learning about other people's lives. And so in college, I would go and audit various language classes just to learn that language system, to understand it, but I'd never go so far that I could pass an exam or be truly proficient in a academic sense. My Russian, for example, part of the reason I went to Kazakhstan was just because I wanted to improve the language and learn the language, and I was able to get conversational in Russian while I was staying in Kazakhstan. But now I have become goal-oriented or short-term oriented by trying to get my Italian to an academic level where I can pass an exam, and I'll be taking an exam here in the near future with the specific goal or outcome of getting a certificate so that I can use it to potentially work in Italy. So I've always enjoyed the journey or the experience of just learning a language, but now I have a specific goal to work towards. It makes it even easier for me because I already enjoy the journey. So when I study Italian or study any language, I'm already flooding my brain with dopamine.
Okay, so that's examples from both of our lives of going from just enjoying the process to shifting that into being more goal-oriented and focused on specific outcomes. Again, we're still looking at all this through the context of habits and forming habits and how to have good habits. So can we think of an example that's not from our lived experience, maybe that we've seen of someone going from one to the other? So we did already kind of talk about musicians or maybe athletes where it's very externally pushed on them by parents or coaches of do this, get good at this, do this practice. And then that kind of morphs into their identity, and then they get along to the enjoying the process part of it. What about going the other way? Not from our lived experience, but maybe some other example from that we've seen in other people.
When you say the other way, you're talking...
Other way meaning enjoying, just enjoying an activity, getting good at something, and then shifting that into short-term focus. I have an example that just came to mind, but I want to hear, you know, what you think.
Sure. The very first example that comes to mind is Mr. Beast on YouTube, where he expresses that when he first started doing videos or making content, that he just enjoyed the process of making videos, thinking about how he can make the next video a little bit better or a little bit more, and how that has transitioned to what he has now, which is quite clearly a business-oriented mindset. And he talks about now he won't even create a video unless he can think of a good thumbnail and title for it beforehand. So now everything is goal-oriented. Not that he uses these words specifically, but he very much talks about, we're making this video to do this thing. Whereas before, when he started, he said he would sit in his car before class just thinking about how he can edit a video better and thinking about the process rather than the product.
Yeah, that's a good example. I don't know that I've ever seen one of his videos, but I know of his videos and I've heard him describe. I'm just not on YouTube that much in general. But I did listen to, I think it was Lex Friedman, interview Mr. Beast, and that was a fascinating interview. I definitely enjoyed just hearing how that guy thinks and the way he looks at stuff. It was a pretty good insight, both into just how he operates and also how the YouTube algorithm operates. The idea that came to mind for me was people that go to school or university with a very clear, you know, goal in mind, like someone who deeply loves a particular subject or particular field, and just they know exactly what they want, and that lines up perfectly with an academic pursuit, and they just go straight in. Academics in general that are successful and make careers out of it, they see that. And they just go for it. So that's a great example of someone who that's part of their identity, and they turn it into a career. I mean, you from PhD school, you I'm sure you were surrounded by people like that.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like the majority of my lab mates were smarter than me. I was surrounded by beautifully intelligent people. One of them that always comes to mind, his name is Jin, and Jin was probably one of the best chemists I ever knew. He woke up and thought about chemistry. He went to the lab and thought about chemistry. He would think about chemistry in the shower. It didn't matter what he was doing. He was thinking about his research, and he is able to publish a paper in Science, which if you are familiar with academic journals, publishing a paper in Science is like a pinnacle keystone that you will be successful for the rest of your career.
I assume that if a journal's name is the more vague in general the name of the journal is, the more prestigious and you know, exclusive it is, like Nature or Medicine.
Yeah. Science and Nature, those two journals are kind of the keystones for any publication. So if you get a paper in there, your career is basically made. And I just still think about Jin sometimes with how dogmatic he was that the thing he had to pursue was a science degree. A truly fascinating human to me, and I could tell that he was just so intelligent in that one direction, and he's going to keep going in that direction, and he was not going to be diverted by sports or learning music or anything else, because he had his passion that he thought about.
I think that's a good segue to kind of bring in Ernest Becker and talk about, now that we're, you know, who knows how far into this podcast so far, kind of talk about what we wanted to talk about in general for today, which was Ernest Becker's denial of death. particularly the concept that I think we can discuss here as a segue is his concept of hero systems and those myths that we adhere to and follow that are given to us by our societies and the ones we make ourselves. So just to kind of bring any listeners up to speed here, let's talk about Ernest Becker's hero systems. Do you want to give us a brief overview of what that is?
Sure. In what Ernest Becker describes in his book, Denial of Death, we create hero systems, or society creates hero systems, which is a way for us to overcome death in some manner. So if we are able to achieve X, then even after our humanly body dies, we will continue to live in society. Large monuments, books, becoming famous, anything you can think of where our society gives you a system of predetermined actions, that's what leaves you with something left after you die. The easiest one given by society is to be a parent. If you're a parent and you have a child, you'll never truly die.
Yeah, and the key thing you said there was it's a way to overcome death. Another way to look at it, at least from what I remember from reading the book, is yes, in a way to, you know, overcome death, but it's also a way to stave off the fear of death itself. So if I am participating in this role in life or society that gives me meaning, that meaning itself is kind of like armor and defense against the fear of death, which Becker says kind of underlies all of our motives and all of what we go through. You know, you can look at what the motivation is for most actions, and Becker would say that underneath those motives or at bottom, a lot of that or most of it is impelled by fear of death itself. The example of being a parent, if you are doing good at fulfilling the role of being a parent or, you know, spouse, then that in itself is a way of overcoming death because you have something that outlives you, but it's also a way to stave off the fear of death because you're less likely to die if you're surrounded by friends and family that love you and people that can take care of you as you get older and survive crises that pop up as a group, as a tribe.
I do think evolutionarily, that's one of the reasons our mind is driving us towards having a herd, and that herd mentality means that we can live longer, typically. I wonder how, as you were talking about that armor, it made me think of novels and books where the protagonist has plot armor, or basically the protagonist can't die, or if he does die, he's revived in some capacity. And at least he doesn't die till the end of the book, usually. So I wonder how Ernest Becker would respond if we asked, as a human, if you're acting as the protagonist and you're participating in a hero system, if that protects you from death, because we have all of these stories of being a hero, and the hero doesn't die until the end. So as long as you're still participating in the hero system, we are pushing off the fear of mortality or the danger of dying because we're still in the middle of the story.
Absolutely. He talks about this a lot in the sections of the book that deal heavily with psychoanalysis and Freud's thinking, that there's a kind of beneficial egotism or narcissism to the stuff we do and the identities we create. So, you know, it's very easy to trick yourself into thinking you're immortal if you force a lot of meaning and importance to your role or the stuff you achieve and identify with. So the more you identify with the myth that you're participating in, and, you know, we're using the word myth here, not in a good or bad sense. It's a neutral sense. It's a role. The more you identify with that and less with, you know, just a human creature that's going to die eventually, the safer you are psychologically from that fear of death. Becker even goes so far as to call it a terror of death. And so we can get wrapped up in that. And also talking about a more Freudian thought, when we're kids, you know, we have little God complexes. The world naturally evolves around us, and hopefully that gets socialized out of us. But we can easily carry that forward into our adult lives. And, you know, if we can convince ourselves that the world revolves around us, then we are an intrinsic part of the universe that can't be removed from the equation without the universe itself not having meaning. Therefore, we kind of are doing a mental trick to have immortality. So yeah, going through a role and hero system, you know, you're an intrinsic part of the story. You know, it doesn't make sense to our story-oriented psychology for the hero not to be a part of the story. You don't have a story without a hero. Therefore, there's no book to be had. So yeah, I think Becker would point that out, and he does in the book. So yeah, you need to be orienting to that role, to that hero system, and make that part of your identity. And if you don't, then, you know, looking back at the evolutionary sense, like you're talking about, if you don't participate in those roles, you don't really have a common language to be a good participant in a society or tribe. You know what I mean?
And I think Ernest Becker, like you were talking about the terror of death, it pushes our psychology, according to his hypothesis, it pushes our psychology to either make some sense of the world with a fantasy or a myth, or it breaks us down. And he talks about the development of various mental disorders as a way to create a different type of hero system or a different answer to that fear of death. The easiest one he talks about is schizophrenia, where you're unable to accept death itself and your mind splits it so that there's something so encompassing for your whole world that that's the best way that you can make sense of life or death.
Same thing with narcissism. Follows the same logic of narcissism or having too inflated of an ego. Which, you know, to rope in what we were talking about earlier with the current book we're discussing in book club of Atomic Habits by James Clear. I think that's a great book. I think there's a lot of cool practical stuff in there. I'm having a lot of fun discussing it. But I think a zoomed out perspective that's healthy to have with that is to also keep in mind that it is really easy to over-identify with your habits and your behaviors and optimization in general. And you can kind of lose perspective on maybe more meaningful things that are harder to tie down to habits and progress and improvement. You know what I mean?
I understand. Especially, I really enjoy these two books and Burnout Society as a nice medium between.
That's exactly what I was just thinking of, yeah.
Between the two. Because if we take the lens of life and we zoom in to a very specific short time frame of our day to day or week to week, we can think about those successes and how if we build habits, we become better. And then a year from now, we're a better person and all these things. Conversely, if we zoom all the way out, we're like, well, our life is so short compared to the universe, to the earth, to all of this, that everything becomes meaningless and we can easily fall into nihilism or absurdism, like Camus talks about, where you end up thinking nothing has meaning because you zoom out too far. And I really enjoy having almost like this variable lens on a camera in our mind where we can zoom in and think about, yes, if I try to be a better husband, if I try to be a better writer, if I try to be a better this, and you take Atomic Habits mentality of increasing 1% every day and zooming in, you can indeed potentially have a better life and set up a better system for yourself, which we should do because we still have life right now and we have to pursue the joy of it and hopefully help others and enjoy all of life in itself. But if we stay stuck in on that zoomed in portion, then like you were saying, we kind of lose track of what is the meaning of life, or what are these things that aren't necessarily quote unquote success, but is still valuable to be had. Sitting and thinking about your mortality, sitting and thinking about your family, or just quietly enjoying the process of living.
Two things here. I think we should bring the listener up to speed by that reference you made to burnout society. So let's put a pin in that and bring that up in a second. But to respond to what you're talking about, the whole point of Ernest Becker's book, at least to my mind, is that okay, yeah, we have this fear of death. It probably motivates a lot of what we do, if not at very bottom, everything we do. Why talk about it then, other than just to stress me out? Really, he says that the importance here is to be aware of the fear of death, be aware that it motivates so much. And again, he would use the word terror to really encapsulate how much of an effect he think it has on us. But to be very clear about that, to think about it and use that as a way to orient yourself and orient your actions. You can catch yourself, for example, if you think that way. I think the practical takeaway from this book is that you can orient yourself around this foundational level of fear of death, not try to resist it, but to catch yourself when you're maybe over-identifying with something or looking at what your motives are behind that. So, for example, you know, this would be potentially maybe looking too deeply into something, but I think it's a useful exercise. Let's look at road rage, for example, where someone cuts you off in traffic and it's very alarming. Some people react with anger, flicking them off, honking the horn. I'm definitely guilty of that, you know, when I'm extra tired or it's very abrupt, you know, honking the horn. And part of that we know from biology is that our bodies are just freaking out because we're in these massive multiple thousand pound, you know, vehicles hurtling down the highway alongside other behemoths hurtling down the highway that could easily kill us. Our bodies are constantly, while we're in a car, freaking out and realizing we are not meant to go this fast. You know, death is imminent. Therefore, when someone cuts us off, at a biological level, our bodies are going to react very viscerally. And psychologically, you know, it's easy for us to lean into that and flick the person off. Ah, you blah, 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 you cut me off. And if we can be aware of that, okay, we're freaking out because we're feeling a sense of danger. And beneath that, you know, hey, my fear of death is being triggered right now because I'm in danger. It helps us, at least in my mind, kind of address that. Like, okay, I realize that I'm feeling threatened because this is endangering. You know, I can work with that and be a little bit calmer. Hey, you're safe. Let's, you know, just a conversation with yourself. And it'll also help you, in my mind, realize when you're falling into certain traps of over-identification, maybe. Like, I'm feeling the pull to, at a subconscious level, over-identify with maybe a certain hobby or a certain thing I like working out. For example, I could be set up for some pain or stumbling blocks if I over-identify with the aspect of my personality that really enjoys working out. Well, if something happens and I get injured and I'm no longer able to work out the way I used to or have a physical life the way I used to, I could be kind of set up to fall into a trap there. Like, part of my identity could be taken from me, and therefore I could feel rudderless or kind of lost. And if I remember that underneath that, you know, this is just a role that I'm voluntarily participating in, and beneath that I'm still there's still a lot more to me than this part of my identity that I'm taking on. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Identity is a key role for human beings. It's been a key role for us ever since we developed into a herd-like animal, and we all pull into ourselves these roles. So identity itself, I think, has a massive weight on all of our actions and the systems that we set up, and we often see people behave in certain ways because of what their identity is, and their identity is a super complex, interconnected, woven aspect, especially in our modern society, of saying, I'm X, you know, faith follower, I'm Y, family member, mother, father, whatever, and you start having these roles and obligations put on you, which fills your life with meaning. I think when you're talking about Ernest Becker, he does a really good job of giving what I would consider a psychoanalytical answer, similar to what Buddhists gave society back a long time ago, which is exactly what you're talking about, where if we zoom out or think about the fear of death, we can use that as a tool to reduce our anxiety or see why we're caught up on a certain emotion or caught up in a certain identity. It's not to be used, or at least my understanding of Ernest Becker's philosophy, is it's not to be used to steer towards nihilism or say, we have a fear of death, that's what drives us, all these hero systems are made up by society, so then you end up believing in nothing or doing nothing. Rather, it's a tool like Buddhism where, hey, this life is small and meaningless, and because of that meaninglessness, you can have a better control of the reins, or and sometimes let go of the reins, like you're talking about road rage, where, all right, that is why I'm acting this way. It's okay. Let me take a step back.
All right, let's take a quick bathroom break and then hop back in.
Sure. I do have to geesh. Now that we have the intro part, let's get back to what we're doing, which is to discuss denial of death. And so to begin all of that, we have here today myself, Joel Serrano.
And I'm Leo Serrano.
And we are bringing you the Deep Dive Book Club podcast, where we hope to give all of you and ourselves a nice overview of books that we get to read and digest and hopefully get to take away practical knowledge and improve our lives bit by bit.
So to kind of back up and talk about the podcast and the goal here and some of the history behind it, like Joel said, you know, we're going over books that we're reading or have recently read and just discussing them. So to give the listener some history here, a few years ago we started a kind of impromptu book club where we pick a book, we read it, and as we're reading it, just meet on it each week and talk about it. I've done this in the past with some close friends. More recently, we've done it maybe a year or so ago, you, me, and a good friend of ours named Dan. And as we did that for a little while, we kind of opened it up to more friends and family. We opened it up to be a little bit more public, posted it on Meetup, and have been meeting and having great discussions with some great people. And it's morphed to be a little bit more discussion prompt oriented than freestyle. And as we were going along, you know, we thought, hey, maybe some people would find it valuable for us to discuss, you know, these on air and chat about them. So this is really just an experiment to see where this can go, what we can do with it. You know, we're still figuring it out as we go. But we love talking about this stuff. So we figured, hey, we'll put a microphone in front of us.
And that's where, if you would like to, we're opening up the podcast book club for you to also join. So as we start moving forward, things will shift and change as we get a better set of how we do this. But we're going to post what book we're going to discuss in the future so that if you would like to read along with us, you are welcome to, and you can send all of your questions or discussion prompts over to us, and we'll be happy to read them and involve everyone in this community where we hope it can be open, engaging, and that we can all learn and grow together. So with that, we are starting with the denial of death.
And then the reason we're starting with the denial of death is because it's one of the best books that we've had discussions on in our book club. We talked about it maybe at the beginning of this year, and it was actually the book that prompted us to start having discussion prompts, just because there was so much we were talking about. Discussions ran for hours. It's dense but very rewarding material to discuss. So yeah, we've already read this one. We figured it'd be a good topic to jump off of because it keeps coming up again and again. But like Joel said, going forward, what we'll do is we will do this live with you guys. So as we are reading books, we're hoping you'll read them along with us or just follow along, and we'll have ongoing discussions about them as we're reading them. And if you have questions, comments, you got something you really want to say about it, send it to us, an email, a chat, whatever way, and then, you know, we'll have an ongoing dialogue, you and me.
And even if you don't read it, you can come and just gain the benefit of our digestion of the book and hopefully a synthesis of some practical knowledge that we can all take away. I'll say one of my favorite things about the book club that we've started and have continued is, like Leo was talking about, this book keeps coming up again and again, along with other books that we're about to tell you about, such as Burnout Society. And the beauty of having this culmination of knowledge is that they're stacking on top of each other to create a knowledge pyramid together. So as we grow and learn, we hope to give that to you in more bite-sized pieces. So earlier we talked about the Burnout Society.
So the topic of today is, of course, Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, as you've probably gathered from the title of the episode. But Joel did reference a little book called Burnout Society by Byung-Chul Han, who's a philosopher living over in Germany right now, a very eccentric guy. Very interesting if you get a chance to read about him. We will be talking about Burnout Society at some point in the future. But to clear up the reference, it's a little book that takes an examines the modern phenomenon of burnout and kind of big trends that have changed over the past 100, 200 years. One of the main ideas is that what's happened in recent history is that we've gone from what Byung-Chul Han calls an obedient society to an achievement society. Obedient society, think of the industrial era where people were very much told what to do and how to think, and that was part of society transitioning to the modern era now, where it's kind of been, those things have kind of been internalized. An example would be feeling the need to make progress. At least in our society here in America, it's very efficient because no one's making you work extra hard, except it's auto exploitation, as he would call it. You have internalized the drive to really achieve, really produce, and kind of agonize over self-improvement and self as a project, which, you know, can make you feel kind of empty and make you prioritize productivity or a sense of productivity over actual meaning and happiness. But we'll jump into Burnout Society later. Let's get back to Denial of Death. We've talked about the concept of the podcast. We've taken a quick look at what that reference was to Burnout Society. So let's jump into Burnout, or into Denial of Death, unless you've got something else you want to cover about any of that first.
Nope, we'll keep bringing in these various references and try to explain it, but that Burnout Society is a great callback to the hero system that we have in our society nowadays. So getting into Ernest Becker's work and talking about his book specifically, we discussed kind of his hypothesis that the fear of death is the driving underlying motivator for all of the actions we do in one way or another. So I'm opening up the gateways for us to get deeper into denial of death now.
Denial of Death came out in 1973. Becker himself died to cancer the year after. The book also received a Pulitzer Prize the year after it was published. To jump back into one of the things that, you know, during the break that I realized I wanted to talk about, Hero Systems, which he also calls immortality projects, is that one of the other practical uses of being aware of the fear of death and its effect on us as individuals and societies is that we lean into these hero systems and immortality projects. But a part of that, you can't have a epic mythical story without the forces of good and evil. An example that Becker gives is a soldier. So in order to be successful and earn prestige and have a successful immortality project as a soldier, you need war. You need destruction at scale, and you need an other that you can label as evil. If we did not have war, which I think we would all agree is a good thing, then that invalidates the potential role of soldier, hero soldier.
Like you're saying, without war, we don't have the good and evil that a soldier can participate in. And if we want a certain role in society, we have to promote that with these mythical legends. The easiest one for an American soldier is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that we have that is guarded 24/7 by a honor guard, and it has a flame perpetually going until the end of time is the idea. And so this gives a pinnacle for the monument of the unknown soldier, or basically, if you participate in our hero system of war, if you die, you are encased in this forever perpetual existence of your life. We'll keep honoring you. So give your life for this nation and you'll never die.
And if we're aware of the motivations behind these hero systems and we're more conscious of them, Becker's point here is that we can kind of more consciously create and choose our own hero systems and choose the ones that we lean into. I think being aware of them does not invalidate them. So if I think about my role as a father or brother or son, and how those may be largely motivated by fear of death, I don't think that invalidates the meaning I can get out of them. I can just be conscious about how those are informing the decisions I make.
I would agree with that. In the same way, a young adult might choose to go to college because the hero system they're participating in is going to this university that has an accreditation, which an accreditation is nothing more than, right, a whole bunch of people agreeing that this is good. And then if you're a young person saying, hey, I'm a student at this university, the majority of society will look positively at you. We have student discounts. People think that you're doing a good thing and you get praise, both actively, usually, and passively from our society saying you're doing a good thing. And that's okay, and there's nothing wrong with it. But like Leo is talking about, being aware of the hero system that you're participating in gives you more autonomy and authority about how you wish to choose to live, about what roles you want to do, and how you yourself can define your own identity.
I think you bring up a good point with the example of going to college. So let's say you go to college to be a scientist of some flavor or another. An important part of how hero systems and immortality projects work are that you actually do need external validation to strengthen those and build those up. So you can't really necessarily, at least in my opinion, create an immortality project without help from people around you and society around you, and the more people, the better. And the opposite is true. The less people, the less strong your hero system or immortality project would be. So to use the example of going to college to be a scientist, you know, getting a degree is a form of external validation. We kind of all agree as a society, all right, you now have the credentials to be or do X, Y, and Z because you got this degree. Our collective faith in what a degree stands for and how valid it is what gives it meaning. You can't necessarily just create a degree and say, hey, I'm a doctor of X, Y, and Z. Certain carnotarists do that, or some people like to just have other people refer to them as doctor without actually having the credentials, but we don't in general appreciate that as a society. And to achieve success as a scientist or academic, you need the external validation of your peers and society in general for that to be valid. If we were to look at maybe like a post-apocalyptic scenario, then depending on the scenario, it doesn't really matter how credentialed you are as an academic, that role is no longer valid. Same thing with the soldier example. It doesn't really matter. You can't really be a soldier without war. And if we were somehow magically able to achieve a world without war, you got to find another project to do. And Becker's point here with this, I think, at least my takeaway, is that you being conscious of how strongly fear death motivates us lets us realize that the potential downside of a hero system is that we need to resist the thing that goes along with that, which is you need evil to be good. So let's find ways that don't create evil, you know, which is tricky. I mean, how can you be a hero and be good without having a counterexample? You know, what do you think of that?
How do you have a protagonist without an antagonist? We don't, as I'm looking at our bookshelf over there, there's no Happy Day number 572 book over there. There is various philosophy books, and in any of the fantasy books, there is a evil to overcome. That evil is sometimes anthropomorphized, or the evil is death itself or anything else, but there's still an evil to overcome by the protagonist. In almost all of our myths and fairy tales, that we, there's no way to get around that. And like you said earlier, we need external validation for whatever that hero system is. If we create our own hero system, that's almost like creating our own currency. Hey, I just printed, you know, another dollar, but it's not a US dollar, it's just a Joel dollar. If no one else agrees that it's worth anything, then it's useless. And I think Ernest Becker talks about cults in the same way, where people go out and try to get other people to validate their hero system.
I don't remember if he brought up cults or if that was just something we were talking about, but either way, cults are a good example of, you can look at cults, and they are definitely a form of hero system and immortality project, but we as a larger society kind of have a problem with them because they are at odds usually with the roles and functions that are already valid in society. It's almost like trying to have a cheat code for achievement. And what one thing I think you'll notice when you look at cults is that they try extra, extra hard to validate what they're talking about. A lot of times when faced with evidence that their beliefs are maybe not as valid as they thought, they will double down and just get even more fanatical about it. And I think all that effort is kind of a good example of the fact that they don't have a lot of external validation, that there aren't a large number of people validating that system for them. So they have to kind of manufacture and synthesize that enthusiasm that's not there from a larger group of people.
I would say that's exactly what is needed. Part of that pursuit in order to get that hero system that Ernest Becker talks about, I think kind of the culmination of him as a person was in the...
Yeah, the forward, or the intro, forward, something like that.
Yeah, whatever it's called. I think that was a beautiful culmination of everything Ernest Becker wrote in his book, because as Leo said earlier, after he had published this, he was dying. Sam Keen was able to go have an interview with him on his deathbed, and we got to see firsthand kind of his approach to his own life. And I think it made it more dignified and gave more weight to his words, and he didn't shy away from that fear of death, but in fact embraced the meaning of his life on his deathbed as he approached everything that he wrote about. And he clearly thought a lot about this, and this is a thoroughly thought-through book when he published it.
He'd been thinking about this for a while. He also had a lot of firsthand experience with war, because I believe he was a soldier, if I'm remembering correctly. And he studied this a lot as a, I think his pursuit as an academic was actually anthropology, if I remember correctly. I mentioned that I wanted to discuss fear of death as a lens to view other actions. I think there's two ways to look at this. A very, like, for me, a practical takeaway that I had was that if we keep it consciously in mind that fear of death motivates a lot of our actions, then for me, that allows me to have a more humane way to view what some people do. The example that comes to mind is narcissism, or someone with a big ego. It's a little bit more easy for me to empathize with them if I look at that egotistical behavior as a defense mechanism. You know, Becker uses ego and narcissism as an example of a strong defense mechanism that we kind of mentioned in the first part of our discussion. Well, if I'm such a vital part of the universe, then, you know, I'm too important to die. And so if I look at someone, and I can think of a few examples of big ego people that I've had to deal with, and see that as, oh, this person, this is their defense mechanism against the terror of their own impending death. That makes me, one, able to kind of understand their motives a little bit better, and two, maybe give them a little bit of grace. Not that that type of behavior should be excused, but I can control the way I go into that situation and handle that situation a little bit better.
I agree with you. I think using it as a tool for empathy has helped me with the world around us now. And the two easy ones to give it a comparison outside of the, oh, okay, that person has road rage, they have a fear of death, but also when we look at not only cults that arise, but conspiracy theorists, where they start going off the deep end and thinking everything's a conspiracy or there's lizard people running the world. I think using Ernest Becker's denial of death lens, we can see that if they know the truth, if they have this bigger than life reality, right, that does a couple of things. One, it's all consuming, where there's a bigger truth out there and you have a bigger purpose and meaning for the universe to provide this truth for others. And second, it often can keep you preoccupied so that you don't have to think about death. If you are in the pursuit of Bigfoot, you don't have to think about the fact that you're going to die or think about the potential that your life is truly meaningless and there's nothing else out there. And I think we see the rise in hedonism when we don't have to worry about food and water, right? We have leisure time now in our modern society because we don't have to worry about pursuing food as a constant daily threat or stress. So getting past that initial hierarchical of need, some people deal with the terror of death by numbing themselves with drugs or constant dopamine of video games or anything else where they'd no longer have to sit and deal with the anxiety of death, which truly can be an overcoming terror. And I don't mean to say any of those things in a negative light, but rather that using the terror of death, the fact that we're human, and looking at how Ernest Becker prescribes people's actions to this base primal fear, you can give people more grace. You can, or for me, I can be less angry or less upset when I hear people say, oh, well, vaccines have never cured anything and they're just killing people. As a scientist, knowing how wrong or false they are, to try to be less angry in my own emotions, because it's like, well, they're participating in their own external hero system. Or at least that's a personal tool I have used from this book.
You're using it the same way that I'm describing as a method to be more empathetic.
Empathetic, graceful. Yeah, absolutely. I'm just agreeing with you with different examples.
You mentioned conspiracy theories. One thing, I don't remember where I read this, but there is a correlation between believing conspiracy theories and narcissism. There's a connection there. If you have a narcissistic tendency, you are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. And if I think about it, it kind of makes sense, because the conspiracy theory aspect is very alluring, and you get to participate in a grand narrative, like, hey, there's lizard people running the world. Well, that's pretty exciting, and I get to participate in that, and I can be on the side of the people that are really in the know. You know, that sounds attractive. I think that's the whole point of playing video games, is you get to participate in a story and suspend disbelief for a little bit. People that, you know, are prone to conspiracy theories or have the allure of conspiracy theories, I think, just kind of skip that step and get to participate in the grand narrative all the time. They have, in some ways, you know, in a very real way, an augmented reality. They're participating in a whole narrative that I don't get to see or participate in. And you can see how much people get into them, and one, they get a sense of importance out of that. And two, that's very time consuming if you're worried about the mole people or the lizard people or, you know, whatever's going on. So I get it. I definitely get it. You don't have time to worry about your own fear of death or impending death if there's a much larger narrative to participate in. The other way that I wanted to talk about the fear of death as a lens to view others' actions is a pretty good quote I pulled out of Denial of Death that I want to bring up. This is Becker talking about the dangers of hero systems and some of the societal turmoil he saw at the time. Remember, this book was written late 60s, early 70s. And during that time, there was a lot of anti-war protest, and young people were getting very disillusioned with stuff going on. Okay, so here it is. Quote, "The great perplexity of our time, the churning of our age, is that the youth have sensed, for better or worse, a great social historical truth. That just as there are useless self-sacrifices in unjust wars, so too is there an ignoble heroics of whole societies. It can be viciously destructive heroics of Hitler's Germany, or the plain, debasing, and silly heroics of the acquisition and display of consumer goods, the piling up of money and privileges that now characterizes whole ways of life, capitalist and Soviet." End quote. I really liked that quote, and that, you know, that's still very relevant today, I think. What do you think about that?
I taking from when we talked about this book before, I've thought about that mentality and have often wondered how true it is. We can see some parallels nowadays as some of the older people that are managers running shops or businesses complain that the younger people don't have the drive to work or the motivation to work, or it's so difficult to get these people to be intrinsically motivated to work hard for 40 years to retire. And when he was talking about this, that was back in the 70s, I believe, in the 60s.
Late 60s, early 70s. Book came out in 73, 74, but based on some of the background research I did and just kind of the sense I get from the book, he spent a long time writing it.
Right. And so we do see almost like a rejection back in the 70s and 60s, some of the counterculture of the peace movements or the hippie movements. And nowadays we see some similar counterculture of rejecting consumerism, rejecting mainstream capitalism of constantly buying. But we also still have the mainstream culture of people pursuing capitalistic gains or pursuing the piling of goods and treasures and hoarding them. So I think there is truth in there because we see the development of these countercultures and anti-consumerism cultures in our society. But we still have the other side of some people choosing to participate in the hero system of gaining more, of getting more money, of piling up their treasures. So I do think it is a good lens to look at why people do what they do. But like any model, I think it encompasses a good amount of actions, but there are some other bits of reality that aren't captured by Ernest Becker's model.
You're saying the like over-identifying with maybe the acquisitiveness that leads one to lean into consumerism and what he calls, you know, piling up consumer goods.
What I'm saying is I think that does identify, he talks about the ignoble hero system, how some young people are rejecting the piling up of consumer goods, but we still had plenty of people still participating in the piling up of consumer goods. Even nowadays, we see both sides where there are some young people saying, well, why would I want to go work for this company where I get shit pay and I just have to work really hard and not really gain anything? Why are you telling me, old person, that I should drive Uber in the morning, then go to a job, and then come back and try to do everything else in order to make my way in the world? I'd rather just enjoy life.
Okay, so you're, so if I'm hearing you right, you're looking at the modern today version of younger people critiquing the handed down heroic systems or you know, immortality projects. Yes. of work hard. So you're looking more at the generational tensions there. Mm-hmm. And different ideas. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I think that's all I wanted to talk about on that part of it. Was there anything else that you wanted to go over from this first episode into Denial of Death?
The only other thing I wanted to bring up in the readings that we did was Kierkegaard's impact on Ernest Becker's work and how Ernest Becker brings up Kierkegaard and he brings up the qualitative leap or the leap of faith. And this is a bit outside of the book itself, but as Kierkegaard describes that qualitative leap or that leap of faith, we have to believe in something beyond our limited reasoning. The easiest one, because Kierkegaard was more interested in theology, was the Christian religion. So you can never truly see God in a realistic sense. And so he says at some point you have to take a leap of faith that beyond your current information that you can gather with your own senses, you have to believe in something. And we do that all the time as we participate in the leap of faith of, say, the US dollar. we go over to the store and we believe that the money we carry with us, we can hand to this person and they'll give us the food that we want. And we believe that that'll work tomorrow and the next day and next week, except for some people that currently have bunkers that they're storing a whole bunch of canned food in.
So what you're doing there, I think, is you're pointing out the gap between reasoning and believing in something, the example being money. Money only works because we all
believe
in it. So you're saying we're creating miniature leaps of faith, you know, okay, we have to bridge the gap between reasoning and something that maybe seems irrational, like a little beyond the scope of what we're able to reason.
Right. And the only reason I brought up money is because that's a day-to-day thing that we make a leap of faith in. But it makes sense that we need to make a larger leap of faith when we are well-fed and we can think about our lives. We have to make a larger leap of faith of whether we believe in a religion or we believe that we're participating in a hero system or we believe nothing will happen, something will happen when we die. But the terror of death drives us to jump off of the cliff.
I'm going to have to go back and review my notes and see how Becker brings Kierkegaard into what he's talking about. Kierkegaard's someone that I definitely want to read and explore his ideas of a little bit more. But yeah, that's definitely something we can take a look at. Anything else you wanted to cover or go over before we wrap up?
No, I think this is a good discussion. Glad we got through this much. There's definitely a whole bunch to unpack in this book. And I think one of the great things about making this book, the first thing that we discussed, is that there is so much to talk about. But one of the downsides here is because it's such a broad spectrum of things we could discuss in this book, I feel like we're leaving out a lot in our discussion, but that's going to be the way it is for this book. So I'm happy that we started here, but also what a difficult first topic to bring in to try to make a holistic cooked pie of a episode.
Right. And so to the listener, you know, let us know what you guys think. Just to kind of give you some more background information, the first couple times we recorded this, I'd written out, you know, 4 or 5 pages of material for us to cover.
10 pages.
Wow, 10 pages. Okay. I wrote a lot for us to cover, and we are trying this version of it. It's just Joel and I just more having a conversation and going off of very loose notes and topics we want to cover from the book. But let us know what you think about this format. Do you want us to be a little bit more concise? We've gone a little long here. Do you want us to be a little bit more, you know, focused on bullet points? Tell us what you like, what you don't like. What's our email?
Our email is, I believe, deep dive.
I've got it right here. deepdivebookclub@gmail.com.
We will also be present on Instagram, I believe also at Deep Dive Book Club. So message us anywhere along there. We would love to hear your thoughts and feelings. As Leo and I continue to grow and develop this, you can expect changes to the episodes themselves. But it's always going to be us just being ourselves, talking about this, and hopefully bringing you practical, everyday actions you can take from these beautiful books that we get to read.
Yeah, we'll land on a format, hopefully with your feedback and input. And one thing I really want to do is any questions or comments you guys have, please send them our way. You know, we'll talk about them on air. And we want you guys to be a part of the discussion. So that's it for now. I think we'll probably do maybe one more episode on denial of death. And as you guys give us ideas about what you want to talk about, we will eventually jump into the format of talking about books as we're reading them.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate you tuning in, if you did. And we'll be back 2 weeks from now.
All right. See you guys then.
All right.